Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Negebauer, and today we'll be talking about Southern Resident Killer Whales in a recent series called Southern Resident Connections, highlighting some fascinating new research. So we'll be talking today with Michael Milstein and Sarah Fesenmeyer from NOAA. And Michael Milstein is a public affairs officer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric West Coast Regional Office. He started out as a reporter covering Yellowstone National Park for the Billings Gazette, then moved to the Oregonian, where he wrote about salmon, water, logging, and more. Then moved to the government side with the Bonneville Power Administration, and then since 2014 to NOAA Fisheries. Sarah Fesenmeyer is a natural resources specialist with NOAA West Coast Region. She worked for NOAA Fisheries for many years, both as a biologist and also in communications. Her work as a biologist has focused on recovering wild Pacific Northwest salmon runs through protecting and restoring their freshwater spawning habitat. This year, one of her communications projects has been researching and writing stories for NOAA Fisheries in a new blog about southern resident orcas. Many stories relate to the salmon that sustain the whales. So the first article of nine so far was published April 1st. The topics include salmon fishing, salmon habitat, microplastics found in killer whale scat, L41 or mega being missing, foraging techniques using sound, and nearshore habitat connections. So Sarah, how did the Southern Resident Connections blog come about, and how were the topics selected?
The blog came about because we really wanted a way to communicate more frequently and more directly with the public about all of the many science and management issues that are related to the southern residents and their recovery. And our biologists, our scientists, our fisheries managers are all involved in so many different aspects of the southern residents' recovery. And we wanted a way to tell the public those stories. We've called the blog Southern Resident Connections because one of our big goals with the blog is to show people the connections between the whales and the broader ecosystem of the West Coast. So to make connections for people between the southern residents and salmon habitat restoration that will help recover our salmon runs that feed the orca, and connections between the pollutants that we put into our water that are affecting the southern residents. So we've been telling those stories, and we will continue with the blog to make those connections. I think one more reason that we wanted to do this blog is we really wanted to give a voice to our dedicated scientists who are so passionate about their work in so many different aspects of southern resident recovery and salmon recovery. So we're hoping to give the public more of an inside look into that work that our scientists do. The way that we are choosing our topics is we're looking at all three of the big threats. We want to tell stories about salmon and salmon recovery, noise, pollution. So we'll keep covering all three of those threats. And we've got some interesting topics coming up that we're going to cover. We're going to look at the fact that seals and sea lions on the West Coast have really recovered very well. And because there are more of them, they're eating more Chinook salmon. So we're going to talk through what does that mean for the southern residents. We want to really explain these complex issues to people. We're also going to explain there's a lot of new science that we know about where different Chinook runs that are really important to the southern residents, where they go in the ocean and how that overlaps with where the whales go. And so we'll tell that story.
What was it like to work with scientists and communicate their research?
It's been a really wonderful experience for me interviewing all of our scientists. They're so passionate about what they do, and they're also really good at telling their story about why their work matters, why it's so important what they're doing on so many different aspects of protecting marine resources. And so I really loved that opportunity to take what they're saying and put it into a great story into our blog. I think a lot of the scientific reports documents that we put out are so dense and technical. They're technical reports. And so it's hard for me, for many of us, I think, to look at that and see the interesting story within those thick documents. So part of this blog is working with our scientists to extract the really interesting stories that are in our technical documents. So there's all this information now on to where different salmon run, where are they migrating in the ocean, where are the whales going, and we can extract that story from a really thick, dense document.
So the first of two articles focus on salmon fishing and southern resident killer whales. Recently, the Pacific Fishery Management Council formed an ad hoc group to assess the impacts of fishing on southern resident killer whales. Michael, can you share a little bit about this process and how people can get involved?
Sure. And in fact, there's a meeting coming up of the work group that people can join. And in addition to what Sarah was talking about with respect to the blog, another goal of ours is not just to make the documents and the science accessible, but to make the processes accessible. We're learning how to make sure that we're including the range of people interested in the southern residents and all the other issues that they touch. It may seem like an intimidating process when you talk about the Endangered Species Act consultation, but in fact that means reviewing the fishing seasons and ensuring that the whales are considered in that process and their prey needs are considered. So this work group was formed, states, tribes, it's very diverse, and they've really dug into the science. They produced a report called the Risk Assessment that's really fascinating in the details it has about how many salmon are off our coast, where they are, where they intersect with the whales, and looking at the question of what sort of tools can we use to make sure that the whales are considered in the process. So one of the thoughts is, do we set a threshold under if salmon fall below this threshold that fishing is cut back in order to make sure that there's enough fish for the whales. Looking also at whether there are ways to increase salmon production in some watersheds. So that's really going to be the focus of this upcoming meeting, and we're looking for public input. That's the way we ensure that we're considering all the concerns and issues out there.
And the ad hoc committee has also put together a risk assessment report, which you have referenced, and it's highlighting some new science related to Columbia River fish that the whales are eating. Can you share a little bit more about some of the important findings?
Yes, the work group actually met numerous times with scientists, both NOAA scientists and others, and in fact some of the scientists actually did specific work for the work group to analyze the question of where are the salmon in the ocean, where are they intersecting with the whales, and which docks the whales are relying on. It turns out when the scientists followed the whales off the west coast, picking up bits of their prey, we're now able to use genetic methods to tell exactly which river that fish came from. And that helps us understand the breadth of watersheds, the diversity of rivers up and down the West Coast that the whales rely on for fish. 90% of the samples that they looked at came from four rivers on the watersheds: Puget Sound, the Fraser River, the Columbia, and the Central Valley of California. People don't necessarily connect the southern residents to California salmon, but in fact that turns out to be an important source of prey for them. When you look at the Columbia River, and the Columbia provided about half of the samples they looked at, it comes not just from the Snake River or from the upper Columbia, but also stocks down below Bonneville Dam in the lower river, where there's many big hatcheries. We know that hatcheries have become an important source of fish coming out of the Columbia, more than half by some measures. When the dams were built and when the canneries were running near Astoria, they developed these hatcheries to make up for the production that the rivers would otherwise provide. The hatchery fish, we realized, also have over time, since the hatchery started, we've realized that they carry some risk for wild fish, which we're also trying to recover. So we need to balance those factors when we're making decisions about fish production, fish hatcheries, and how best to protect the wild populations.
In the blog series, it mentions that not only do Washington and Oregon fisheries impact southern resident killer whales, but perhaps Canadian and Alaskan fisheries also have significant overlap with the whales. Some groups have argued and even been successful in court arguing that Alaskan fisheries are causing harm to southern resident killer whales. What's being done to address this?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, that it goes to the migration routes of these different stocks of salmon, and we know that different stocks go to different places in the ocean. There's a map in with one of our articles that shows the kind of superhighway of salmon that move up the West Coast, migrating out into the Gulf of Alaska. And they do pass through British Columbia and Alaska, and are caught there. The Pacific Salmon Treaty is really the framework by which we look at that fishing and try to make sure it's equitable, and increasingly make sure that it's also respecting the needs of the killer whales. There's been a new agreement under the Pacific Salmon Treaty in 2019 that actually does a number of things that are good for the whales. It includes reductions in fishing in both Alaska and British Columbia. It also includes habitat improvements for some of these threatened Puget Sound Chinook stocks that are caught on their way to back from Alaska, actually. So there's some benefits there for the whales, and it really demonstrates how connected we are in the Northwest to Alaska and the other areas that the fish migrate through.
The two articles that I think I found most interesting were the ones about microplastics in killer whale poop, or scat. This research is being led by Kim Parsons, and the process is described in the article. It says, quote, "Scientists dried out a subset of the largest fecal samples in a lab oven for up to 48 hours. They removed the remaining biological matter with hydrogen peroxide and then began to isolate and identify what was left, which was bits of plastic." Sarah, what are the potential harmful effects of these microplastics on southern resident killer whales?
Yeah, well, that is a really good question. So first, what we know about microplastics, bits of plastic that are 5 millimeters or less, is that they are everywhere in the ocean. And scientists have found them in every organism where they've looked for them. And now what we do know is, through Kim Parsons' work, we've also found them in the poop of the southern residents. So we know that microplastics have been in the guts of southern residents. And so then your question is, like, what does that mean? Do we know if that's bad for the whales? And the answer is, we don't know yet, but our researchers are certainly concerned, because plastics often have many chemicals, sometimes there are additives to plastics that can be harmful. Chemicals like BPA, and many others. And some of these chemicals are endocrine disruptors. That means that they disrupt the natural hormones of the whales, potentially of the whales. And that could cause negative impacts to the whale's reproduction, to development. And we know our southern residents are already in trouble there. So this would be a big concern. So we'll keep studying. We don't know what the exact effects are right now, but we're certainly concerned.
And Michael, if it is determined that these microplastics are a problem, how could they be managed?
Yeah, that sort of goes to the challenge of this third threat to the whales, which we generally think of as pollution and contaminants that build up in their blubber, in their system. We know now that pharmaceuticals from our wastewater are getting into juvenile salmon in Puget Sound. And are they getting to the whales? Maybe so. The challenge with the question of pollution is it's a little more difficult to get your arms around because it's so diffuse and often spread out. So we have to look at the ways that we're living and disposing of our waste as well, to try to control the impacts on the whales.
Habitat restoration was a central theme to these articles. Sarah, what's the most significant or exciting project or effort that's in the works right now that could benefit southern resident killer whales?
Well, that's a tough question for me because I think there are so many exciting salmon habitat restoration projects that are going on up and down the West Coast and that will be benefiting Chinook salmon stocks that are important to the whales at different parts of the year. So I'm excited about many different projects, and I think in the blog we're going to cover a whole range of projects. But if I had to pick one or a set of projects that's really exciting right now, I think it is the tidal marsh restoration that's going on in Puget Sound. We know Puget Sound Chinook are definitely one of the key stocks for the southern residents, and many of those populations are declining and need help. And so habitat restoration is one way to do that. And one thing we know is that when juvenile Puget Sound salmon leave fresh water right when they enter the ocean, and they're really small at this point, 60 millimeters, when they get there, the bigger they are, the better their chance of survival in those first few weeks or months, not getting eaten by a predator. And so we know that if we can increase their survival right at that life stage, we can increase the number of adults that we have coming back. And one thing that will increase the size of those juveniles when they hit the ocean is having tidal marsh habitat right at the end of their rivers that they can go into and fatten up. And yet, in Puget Sound, we've lost a huge percentage of our tidal marsh habitat to industry and agriculture and development. And so that habitat is gone, but there are a lot of amazing efforts right now going on with a lot of different partners to restore that habitat, to take fields and turn them back into tidal wetlands. And so one of the projects, a group of projects that we're gonna highlight on the blog are called the Lekwe Island and Zizaba Tidal Marsh Restoration, and those are sponsored by Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife and the Stillaguamish Tribe. And they're really exciting. One of the biologists working on those projects described it to me as, if you think of restoring a forest, it may take 100 years to get tall trees back to where that forest used to be. But if you want to restore tidal marsh habitat, you can take a field and dig some channels and reintroduce salt water, and 3 years later you could have tidal marsh vegetation and you can have channels where Chinook salmon could be growing in these very productive channel habitat where Chinook salmon could be growing bigger before they hit the ocean. And in fact, that's, they sort of anecdotally, the biologists are now seeing that juvenile Chinook salmon are using their restored habitat. So I think that is really exciting to see.
Yeah, and I didn't know about how quickly that habitat can be restored. That's very exciting, as I know a lot of our listeners are looking for ways that the whales can get more to eat as soon as possible. So that's exciting to hear about. Michael, in addition to reading these articles and learning more, what else can you share with our listeners who are dedicated to helping southern resident killer whales, salmon, and the Salish Sea?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, by trying to make the science accessible, we're trying to also give people the power to engage in these processes. I mean, if we're sitting in the Northwest, you're probably sitting in or near salmon habitat. So it's not just what we do every day, but it's how we dispose of our waste, how we live our lives in a way that that reduces the footprint. And there are a number of excellent watershed groups that are pursuing habitat projects. So I think there's a couple things we can do, both controlling our impacts on habitat that's there and protecting what we have, but also going out and developing more habitat, as Sarah was talking about. So the small act of planting vegetation along a stream that's going to shade the water and help the fish survive can make a huge difference when we're talking about thousands or hopefully even millions of people thinking that way. So I think it's a combination of both tracking the processes, following the science, so you can give effective input and see where some of the options are, as well as and we have a brochure on our website as well that offers different examples of how people can help the whales in their everyday life, and it goes to things like making sure that when we're changing oil in the car, we're not letting that run down the gutter and into the storm drain and the storm water that leads to the streams where the salmon and the ocean and the whales are.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much. I will also include links to these resources, the brochure, links to the blog, and upcoming information about the Pacific Fisheries Management Council meeting. As always, if you enjoyed listening today, I invite you to go up to the Whale Scout website to listen to more podcasts. You can also follow us on our new YouTube channel. Michael and Sarah, thank you so much for talking today. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat and share more about what you all are working on.
Thank you so much.